This podcast is brought to you by The Shift.
This podcast is brought to you first and foremost by the patrons on the Storytime Superhero tier on Patreon. Please consider becoming a patron of the podcast if you aren't already. And this podcast is also sponsored by Skillshare. So during the month of April, sign up for Skillshare using my link below and get 40% off a yearly subscription. The link is in the description box on YouTube and in the show notes on the audio platforms. So members of Skillshare have access to over 135,000 classes in music, design, web development, photography, animation, illustration, and much more. Classes can include prompts, resources, hands-on projects, and you can also share, collaborate, and network with the growing community of millions of creators on Skillshare. I myself use Skillshare to teach myself code at the very beginning of COVID lockdown last year. And even though I did eventually get bored and give up, just being honest, I did learn how to run a module in Python that told me I had a lovely name. And when I entered my friend Kelly's name, it told her that Carol Baskin killed her husband. That was a joke that made sense in March 2020. It was a joke that made sense a year ago, okay? So click the link in the description below for 40% off a yearly subscription when you sign up in April 2021. And after that, if you're listening to this podcast, after that, use code CLISARE, C-L-I-S-A-R-E, for a two-month trial, a free two-month trial. So let's get on with the episode.
It's story time!
Hello and welcome back to the Storytime Podcast. My name is Claire. I go by Clizair on the internet. And today I have with me Dominic. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Dominic Caparelli. Most people call me Cappy. It's a side effect of joining a circus.
And yeah, so tell, you have a good story for me today. Or like,
yeah,
a sort of... life story.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I'm happy to say I've had a very storied life. It's been fun, not always easy. But yeah, so I mean, really, I think the fun start and kind of, you know, a sentence just to make the whole thing start off as absurd as the rest of the story is, really when I was 24, I went through a horrible breakup. Just a couple of weeks before I had brain surgery. So, you know, laying in a hospital bed for a while, it was kind of like, well, what the hell am I going to do now? And by some reason, I decided to join a circus. yeah, it's, you know, it's kind of a weird start to a weird story. But yeah, so I literally upped and packed and I went on tour with Cirque du Soleil. Went with them. Wow. I was with them for 4 years.
But how did you get involved? Like,
so I'm a technician. My background is all engineering and technical audio and video and things of that nature. And I did okay doing that stuff. But where I really excelled was repairing and troubleshooting systems. So I ended up, through a friend, kind of got recommended, and I ended up going on tour. My job was literally to sit around and wait for things to break. That was my job. It was a great time. Now, obviously I got dragged into plenty of other roles, but, no, it was great. And it was, like I said, 4 years, and I went home for 9 days a year.
Wow.
So, it was intense. So
you're living in Belfast now, you said.
So I'm living in Belfast. I went to Australia on the tour and, met one of the lovely Irish women that was down there visiting her sister. Believe it or not. So, so by pure dumb luck, I managed to meet the woman I would end up marrying. So, yeah, we ended up, she toured around Australia with me working for the tour. And then when we eventually ended up in Europe, we got married in London. We had a child in Germany. And at that point, we kind of went, this is really hard. And we actually went and moved to the States. We lived there for about a decade, and then we moved here 3 years ago. So we've been up in Northern Ireland since.
And what did she work as on the circus? In the circus?
So she worked in the front of house. She worked. So when she first started, she was working just as local hire staff. And that's when we met. now, once our relationship became a thing, she was actually able to sort of advance up, and she worked as one of the front of house managers while we were in Australia. And it worked out great. The way the tour was structured and the way the traveling worked, she didn't need any sort of special permissions or extra permits or anything like that. She was able to just kind of hop on and hop along with us. And then until we got to Europe, and by that point, you know, we had kind of figured out that we were, you know, starting a relationship, getting married, having a child, you know, so she wasn't, you know, she wasn't working when we got to Europe. She was worrying about childcare, which when touring, interesting. Prenatal care was a lot of going to doctors and being like, so here's the story, and we're only here for 4 weeks of care. You know, wow. And doctors kind of look at you like, what's wrong with you? It's like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, that seems really hard.
It was, yeah, I mean, we didn't really plan it that way, but we decided to roll with it when it happened. And we rolled with it. And actually, it was even crazier. So my tour was, I don't remember where we were. We were in a country, and we were going to Berlin for the next stop on the tour. And in the prenatal care, there was some concerns that were raised by the doctors, and they wanted to induce labor and kind of get things rolling. And it was like, but I have to leave in, you know, a week. I can't, you know, like my tour moves, and that's, you know, like that's everything. And Cirque was, I mean, they were amazing. They actually, because they went, hey, we're going to have to pay for a hotel for you either way, we'll just book your hotel in Germany early. And they did. So they let me leave wherever it was we were and go to Germany early with my wife. We literally got on a train, she couldn't fly, got on a train, got to Berlin, went to the hotel where they got us, dropped our bags off, got in a taxi, went to the hospital.
Wow.
And just showed up, and, you know, again, you know, the doctors had all communicated across the country lines, but it was still, you know, you kind of get there, the doctors are like, so we were told you want to do this. Is that right? And you're like, yeah. Yeah, it is. And they're like, okay, well, let's go. And it was kind of really surreal. Like I said, the tour did a great job. It was wild, and going into, you know, and also a healthcare system that neither of us knew. You know, the German system is different than, you know, the system in the UK or Ireland, or, you know, certainly different than the States, where I had known things, so we were kind of a bit at a loss. And we were also in a hospital on the side of Berlin where the primary Englishes were, or the primary languages were Russian and German.
Wow.
Instead of
okay.
The other. So the only people we could talk to were doctors.
And so you're American and she's Australian, right?
Yes. No, she's Irish.
Oh, she's Irish. Oh, so
she was there visiting a sister who lives.
Sorry, yes.
Yeah.
So in Europe, she would actually have her health care. That'd be covered, wouldn't it? I'm not actually sure how it works, because I know that, like, in America, you guys need health insurance, don't you? Like, what I'm asking is, how did that get covered when you landed into a country and you were like, here,
so
a baby is coming.
it's not as easy as you would think. It's a real convoluted. So I was an American who worked for a Canadian company. And as that, the Canadian company needed to provide healthcare to its employees everywhere in the world as if it was in Canada, which is, you know, fully socialized healthcare. So Cirque, when you have Cirque, you have truly amazing insurance. It's just 100% a cover. It's like, if your provider will pay for it, great. If they won't, you pay for it, send us the bill, we'll pay you. Like the way that Cirque has. So we opted to do that route, which we didn't use her European movement rights, which means, since I could not read any of the letters that the hospital sent to me, we may still actually owe money for my son's birth in Germany. Not sure. Haven't been back since. But it was one of those, like I said, the only people we could talk to was doctors. So I was trying to get them to get the hospital to deal with my insurance company. But everything was in German. I had no clue what was going on. Nobody could translate. So a doctor would come up to me and be like, hey, billing said you got to do something. Thanks, bye. You're like, okay. You know, and I'd take a letter, I'd shove it in an envelope to my insurance company and be like, something will happen. I still don't know what ever happened. One doctor at one point came to me and was like, look, billing really wants to get this worked out. And I'm like, okay, as an American, I'm thinking the American healthcare system and also Americans. So I'm like, okay, so I'm trying to work this out. I don't want to be screwing the hospital. How much time do I have? He goes, well, it needs to be taken care of quickly. I'm like, okay, but if I need some time, how long do I have before I get in some sort of trouble? He goes, well, if you don't take care of it soon, they'll send you a letter. Okay. And then what? I'm like, is my work visa in trouble, or will they come after me like collections? I don't know if that's a thing in Germany. I'm like, what? He goes, well, it's going to be a strongly worded letter. I'm like, got it. Thank you. Send your letters. I can't read them anyway. So, yeah, but like, I don't know. We just sort of, you know, and then my tour. Well, actually, once our child was born, we left tour because there were perceived health problems that turned out to not really be anything. But, you know, we kind of, you know, so once he was born and able to travel, it's like, okay, we need to go. We need to settle somewhere so we can take care of the health stuff. So we left after Germany, but I've no clue what my current situation is in Germany. So we do want to travel there. I have a feeling that if it's a problem, I will find out. So I haven't quite gotten there yet. But yeah,
we've jumped straight to the end of your second.
Right, straight to the end. Yes.
And that was it.
And here I am. I had the greatest.
Yeah, so sorry, I jumped you ahead. You can take me back to the start of your circus.
So I had done some stuff in rock and roll and some stuff in theater before, and those are relatively short-lived, you know, like I had never got on like a big, huge international rock tour. I did like small bands doing little things for, you know, a couple of months, a few weeks. You know, in theater, stuff is fun as hell, but it is no money. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, you're waiting at the end of the day to ask catering if you can take any of the extras home. And I wasn't real cool with that. So I ended up doing like corporate stuff, which was fun and interesting. But it's, you know, like sitting still wasn't for me. So when I joined the Cirque Tour, something that really struck me quickly is because Cirque Tours, the one I was on was 150 traveling people. It's a big group of people, and 50 of them, give or take, were performers. So you got 100 support staff. It is like school. It is this big group of people that never leave each other's side. I mean, literally all are traveling from location to location. You're the only people you know in every city, and you're on tour for, you know, 50 weeks a year or something. So it's, you know, it becomes a bit of a family, but it also kind of turns into that gossipy school crap. And something that I did real quick. So as I said, my name's Dominic. I go by Cappy. Cirque du Soleil is French Canadian. There are a lot of Dominics, men and women. I mean, like, everybody's Dominic. It's amazing. You know, like, really? I've gone through my whole life. The only Dominics I ever knew were, you know, I'm Dominic the Third. My dad and my grandfather were the only Dominics I really knew. And then you join circuits like, this is Dominic. And I was like, holy crap. Like,
I didn't know the name was that popular.
It's a pretty popular Dominic or Dominique. And then, you know, and it's funny, they do some weird enunciation things on some of the names that they think they're giving people a nickname. So usually people call me Dom. So one of the guys on our tour, Dominic, went by Doom. That's different enough from Dom. That was a distinction they were able to make. But so I went by Cappy for my last name. One of the things that I quickly learned on this tour was gossip was king. And I am not a gossip person. So, you know, I immediately, when I joined tour, I just owned whatever dirtbag thing it was that anybody could talk about. You know, like you'd come onto a work site one day and somebody like, oh, we heard you went to a strip club. I was like, hell yeah, I went to a strip club. I was high as a kite too. You know, like, you know, and it blew people away. We're like, you're just gonna admit it? Well, why the hell not? That's where I went, you know, like, yeah. And I kind of, you know, I don't think people were quite 100% ready for it. And it kind of caught people surprise. And what ended up happening is because I was so open and, I mean, I was young and obnoxious, it became what was called a Cappy trail. And literally people would just ask me like, where are you going? So Sunday nights were our night out because Monday was the dark day. So Sunday nights, people would just,
yeah, I know dark, what you no mean, shows. But it's...
No shows.
So bad.
Well, and it actually, I guess it kind of rolls into what I'm talking about too. So, so Sunday nights were the big drinking night. And it turned out people would just start asking me like, where are you going to drink tonight? And And it turned into this whole thing where people would just start showing up wherever I was because they knew that I was just going to get obnoxious because I just love screwing with everybody's head. It was so much fun. You know, and in some places it was more interesting than not. I got some of the greatest times and stories I have were in Sydney on Oxford Street. Because they put us at a hotel at one end of Oxford Street and our work site was at the other end. So we were just every day up and down. And that's just this crazy, you know, kind of LGBT nightlife drag right through town. And, or well, it's off to the side, but right through where we were going every day. And yeah, people would just kind of come up to me like, where are you going?
You like the tour guides.
Yeah. Well, and it was called the Cappy Trail. So at my bachelor party, they made a shirt for me that says the final Cappy Trail.
So, brilliant.
Yeah. So, I mean, it kind of turned into a whole thing for a while. And there were plenty of nights with, you know, phone calls, you know, waking up to people going, where are you? What do you mean? They're like, well, you called me 82 times and said you're in trouble. I'm like, oh, like, where am I? That's a good question. I'm going to step outside. it was fun. And, but yeah, so that was kind of how I made my way through tour life. I decided, you know, I was just going for the sex, drugs, and rock and roll, sex, drugs, and circus. And, yeah, it was, got, you know, I think probably, one favorite story of somebody. So Cirque would often put you in roommate situations, especially in the States. They put you in, like apartments, like corporate apartments, because you'd be everywhere for a month or so. So, you know, if they could avoid hotels, they'd put you in. So you'd be in like a 2-bedroom apartment with a roommate. And I ended up in one where I think I was staying with two couples. Oh, no, one couple and another guy from tour. And I actually remember it was a gentleman named Spencer. And Spencer was like 18 years old and he was hysterical because he acted like a teenager. Like he'd be running around like a crazy maniac and then he would just be like and fall asleep wherever he just happened to be. It was like a toddler. It was really hysterical. So it was him and me and then this couple. And the couple was a lesbian couple of two lovely women who had a very fiery relationship.
Okay.
So there were times where they would be coming and going at, you know, odd points in time and, or sleeping out on a sofa. And there was a day that I came out of my bedroom and one of them was on the sofa and she just looked at me and was like, what happened? I just looked there, I'm like, what are you talking about? She goes, well, for starters, look down. I looked down, I was not naked. I was wearing a shirt as a skirt with my whole body through the neck hole. and, you know, it was one of those, like, you know, turn and you look in the bedroom and the mattress was sideways and there were bed sheets were everywhere. It was just kind of like, I honestly don't even know how I got home. So and then she's like, and what about the person who was with you? It's like, there's a person in there? Holy shit. So I don't know where I slept, but there was a person sleeping on a fully bedded closet in the bedroom with me. It's kind of one of those like, oh, like that's a fun situation. I have no clues. There I was wearing a t-shirt as a skirt with a stranger in my bedroom. And this poor woman was sitting there like, just like, I think I'm okay with my girlfriend. I'm going to go back in. Like, all right, cool. Thank you. Bye.
So you sent me a picture and the picture is probably the one I'm going to use for the thumbnail. But did I misunderstand you when I said when you got involved in the circus originally as like an audio engineer?
No, I started as just a general tech. My title was electronics maintenance coordinator. My job was.
Yeah, so definitely that picture didn't. I thought you were going to be like on the trapeze or something. Like
No. That's just one of my.
As you when say, people think sex, of circus, drugs, and this, circus is a good way to describe that picture.
Yeah, when people think of circus or especially Cirque du Soleil, they think it's nice, clean sort of thing. And yeah, that photo is a great one. That's one of those ones that you're just like, this is what I think of when, yeah. You know, when I see the circuses, you know, and we got a lot of photos like that. It was always fun getting people like that involved. The gentleman in that photo, we actually, he was great. He would join the tech crew from time to time and actually run show cues because he just wanted to see what it was we were doing.
So that photograph he sent me is not of you.
No, no. You want a photograph of me? Oh, I got a, oh, I got a great one. I can send you. It's actually one that's been made fun of for years and years and years. Sir, I was on a big top tour, a tent. And so everything has to be supported off of the masts of the tent. So we'd have to build these large apparatus on there to do all the stuff we needed them to do. In building it, they were tons of pieces. And there's a great photo of me sitting there with all the pieces on the ground looking like I'm confused as hell. I wasn't. I knew what I was doing. It was a poorly timed photo. I'll have to share that one with you because that's a good one. And then I can also share one that a road case that I had commissioned that's, God, I don't even know, it was 16, 17 feet tall and it stands straight up on end. So it's like standing next to a damn building. You're just like, this is stupid.
Yeah. So, okay. So Cirque du Soleil is a little bit different to the kind of circus that I'd have in my mind, isn't it? It's not like an animal, or is it? Or is
it more dancing? Animals.
Yeah. It's like an aerial circus, isn't it?
Yeah. It's all performer based. So no animals. It is, yeah, it's so in all the tours tend to kind of theme themselves in different ways. The tour I was on was sort of the about the way nature interacts with itself. It's one of those things, if someone tells you and walks you through the storyline, it all makes sense. If you don't have a clue, you're never going to have a clue.
Yeah.
You know, it's very kind of subtle in that way where if you really want to get into Well, I don't know if this has changed. Well, it would have changed with Love and Michael Jackson, but generally Cirque shows don't use any language. Like they're speaking gibberish on purpose. Okay. I believe I've heard in the past, and I don't know if this is true, but I believe the tours tend to focus semi on geographical regions.
Okay.
So the tour I was on sort of focused on Asia, Russia sort of region. You know, most of our performers were, you know, from either Russia, Ukraine, Georgia. And then we had a few from China.
And then did the story, I guess, that you guys were telling in the show, does that change? Does the show change?
No.
Ever? Really?
No, they do. Of course, there's a couple of axe in the pocket in case somebody's ill or something like that. The tours travel with an artistic director, which isn't surprising, but unlike a lot of tours, that artistic director is there to maintain the artistic vision. They are not adjusting. And on a regular basis, you'd have the creative staff come out and sort of look at and see what was going on. Location transfer, sometimes you might adjust. Maybe certain acts wouldn't work well in certain areas, you know, certain geographical regions. Some things might not just seem quite as interesting. So in those cases, that might be changed up.
So interesting. So it's not like going to two different plays, for example, like where the same actors being two different. It's the same show.
The tour I was on performed exactly the same for 12 years.
With
incremental adjustments. But for 12 years, it was the same cast of people, roughly the same grouping of equipment, you know, the same amount or type of staff. Cirque has started. So my tour eventually got converted from a big top into an arena tour. It was able to get into some smaller markets. I believe they actually came to Belfast at one point, so that they could start hitting, because Cirque, you know, the big top tours, they're expensive. They're difficult. It's a lot of stuff. I mean, we were 48 trucks of equipment for that one tour, you know, so you set up for one place. When we were like in Sydney, the big top would seat well over 2,000 people. And we were in Sydney for almost 3 months. Just because there's that much demand.
Wow. But
in Australia, we only went to 4 or 5 locations. And then, you know, we popped over to New Zealand. But I mean, for all of Australia, you only go to 4 or 5 spots because those are the only places that can bring enough people. So Cirque started changing some of that to get, you know, to be able to get into local venues. And they started changing some of their stuff to tours. And it's worked really well for them. I was gone before that.
And when you mention Australia, like, does it go around and then go again, if you know what I mean? Or did you only go to Australia once in all those 12 years?
Once, once. So they would go to Australia, and then Cirque does a very good planning job. They have any number of tours, and in certain markets, they aspire to have a tour there every 2 years. And I believe that's, in Australia, that was kind of the formula, so like Sydney will have a tour every 2 years, but it's the next one. It's always the next one. Some of those aren't true. Like they went to Royal Albert Hall twice. I did the first job in Royal Albert Hall when they did it. And then kind of after they finished up Europe, they hit the Royal Albert Hall one more time before it left Europe. But that's generally not the norm. It doesn't usually go to one tour would not go to the same place twice, generally.
So yeah, I'm still totally confused. So like, like, what do you mean one tour? So there's more than one.
Oh, Cirque has, at any given time, there's a dozen different shows touring.
All in different places.
All in different places.
And that show is that show. And so you stuck with your one.
Yeah. So the show I was with was Verikai. So I was always with Verikai. None of the other tours did Verikai. My tour was Verikai. So we would do that one spot. And then we went and did the next one. And then like the show that came on after mine was called Corteo. So Verikai went to Sydney 1 year, 2 years later, Corteo would show up.
Okay, now I understand. Yeah, got you. And then is each tour, so you're calling them tours. So is each tour then got a different show? Are they all doing the same routine? Yeah, nope, okay. So they are all different. Yeah. So that's what I was trying to get at. Yeah,
all cast is unique. All crew is unique. All the equipment, the set, everything is unique to each tour.
Yes.
So like the tour I was on was one of the first tours that Cirque done that actually included automation, high speed winches and stuff.
Wow.
Because they didn't really before that, they didn't know how they could integrate that safely into a tour environment. So the tour I was on, we had two turntables, a lift and four winches. That doesn't mean a lot, but the tour that went after us like tripled all those numbers.
Okay.
Because they kind of stuck their foot in with ours and kind of went, okay, is this going to work? Okay. And our tour did just fine with it. So then the next tour, they really embraced the technology, and that tour has a ton of that technology in it. So, Cirque kind of keeps everything evolving as it moves forward. And it's part of the reason for their success.
Sorry, when you say the tour that came after us, what do you mean?
So like I was with this group of people, this group of technicians, this group of actors, that was a tour. That was a unit. We moved. And then Corteo was another tour. They were doing the exact same thing, but they had their own set of equipment, their own set of performers, their own set of technicians, and they were doing that. So while Verikai was touring around Australia, Corteo was touring around North America.
Yeah.
And at the time I was on tour, I believe there were six tours from Cirque, all in different places at the same time, all doing different shows.
Cool. That's a much bigger operation than I think I realized.
That most people did Cirque, for a big top tour anyways, you start with a parking lot. I mean, they run the sewage lines, the power lines, the water lines, and we traveled with all of it. It all came in trucks. We didn't plug into local power. We had generators. It's literally a complete self-contained city. There were bathrooms, kitchens, dining areas, schools for the children. It's intense, the amount of stuff and work that went into it. And especially if you talk about it, 48 trucks worth of stuff, and it would be built in 5 days.
Whoa.
And including running water, running sewage. There were locations where we couldn't hook up to a local sewer, so they'd have to bring in a tank. They'd have to bring in a tank of water and it'd have to get emptied regularly. I mean, it was completely self-contained. You could be out in the middle of nowhere and you could have a Cirque du Soleil show. And I mean, they wouldn't bat an eyelash.
And so what was your job? Like what, as in your tasks, I guess. I suppose you probably got involved in everything, but like what was your main?
Well, so my job was mainly during when the tour was setting up or tearing down. Mainly during setting up, my job was really to go through the critical equipment that was in use and make sure that it was in good working order so that with any luck, it wouldn't fail during the show. Cirque has a lot of backups for that kind of thing. So, a lot of times cleaning things and just sort of taking things apart, making sure everything looked good, nothing got bent or destroyed. Australia was really weird. People I never would have thought of this either. But so when you're in North America and Europe, all the trucks and everything travel by trucks, you know, they got wheels, and I know it sounds a little pedantic, but in Australia, it's in sea containers. And then those sea containers are put on trains. And you would not believe the amount of damage a train can do, just because when you're on wheels, those wheels are rubber and they're filled with air. So yeah, there's a certain amount of vibration that's taken over on a train. There's nothing taken out. That all that track that's all metal wheels with metal systems, we would literally have screws just come out of equipment. Like my job in Australia, I'd spend a day literally just, I'd have to take covers off a thing and just screw the screws back in, because the screws would just wiggle out and all the shaking on trains. It was kind of one of those things, you know, the first time we did it, it was kind of like, what is going on? You know, of course you tell an Australian, they're like, oh yeah, trains.
Like, and trains, then did, and then do you like feed that back up to like Cirque du Soleil, the company?
Yeah.
And then they put in place, I don't know, padding or something in their boxes the next time for the next tour.
That was sort of a situation where we just sort of had to handle it as we did. There was no, you know, it's kind of like, they're like, hey, it's going by train, do what you have to. You know, we learned some, you know, you learn how to use things. There's like adhesives out there made specifically for screws and things like that, that, you know, you just kind of had to sort out and figure out as you went. And
yeah, but I just mean for the tours coming after you, was there anything then put in place? Or
there is a reporting system to kind of say, you know, here's what we found, here are the challenges we ran into. And that would be more, you know, that could get to any level of stuff. You know, there was a time where we had to figure out a safety system for a trapdoor. You know, it's one of those sort of weird situations where, you know, even as a technician, you're kind of like, what the hell? I worked with another gentleman on the tour, and we, you know, we sort of fit, you know, we've came up with a solution. And then there is a portal, or, I mean, there certainly was at that point, and I'm sure there is now, where you would go, hey, anybody else who runs into this situation, you know, and then I, you know, somebody could go in and they could say, oh, I have a problem with a trapdoor, and they could say trapdoors, and they'd see what, you know, anything people had said about, here are things we've done on trapdoors. And you would, you know, and then you'd either have an idea or you knew you had to figure something out yourself. It was a good system. It worked mostly, you know, there were certainly times where, you know, opinion would come into it that, you know, didn't always work, or, you know, operation, just the way people work through things. If a cue light, you know, it's just a simple light that goes red to green to tell somebody to do something. Some of those have a little button on them so that if somebody says stand by, the light goes red, but maybe that light starts blinking and there's a button that they push to tell the person at the other end, yeah, I am ready. Well, if we would have those things mounted in the air to kind of make big announcements, but that meant we had like a dozen blinking lights in the air. It was like, wow, that system that everybody recommended just screwed us.
Doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and then you're in one of those situations like, well, now we're going to have to figure out something really crazy. And that's where you end up like hanging upside down in the air with, you know, like a soldering iron, like, God, work you thing, you know, and you're
did
just
kind of, you ever have to do that? Did you ever have to?
There was one of my favorite experiences, because I still don't know what the hell I was thinking. So there was a portion in our show where performers would just kind of come out of the air, and they were on big winches above, and then the performers were also clipped to a rope, and there was a technician at the side that pulled them to the side, so they kind of looked like they were flying a little bit. That rope off to the side actually went through what's called a capstan winch. It's, you know, it's just a wheel that's turning that helps you pull the rope. That broke.
Oh.
Right in the middle of a performer being pulled up. So the performer was held on this rope that couldn't go anywhere, and the other rope couldn't take him up because this rope was stuck. And this was one of the times I was just sitting backstage, waiting, you know, just there in case something happened. And a call came on the radio like, you know, holy shit, this is broken. I got a performer stuck in the air and a show's going on. So, you know, the immediately thought was, I'll go look at that control box and make sure it's still plugged in, you know, because that winch is plugged into something that makes it work. So I open up that box and I tell the guy, hey, try turning it on. And he does. And I'm looking at it, and there's this big, huge electrical contactor. It's this big thing like this. It's got giant wires running in and out of it. And all it is it's a big switch for lots of electricity. Well, I could see that that wasn't working. So kind of did one of those like quick little, you know, and I took my finger and I shoved it into the big electrical thing to turn it on. I go, okay, do it now.
Oh my God.
The guy hit it and performer like, oh, I'm like, are you done? He's like, yeah, I'm done. I'm like, okay, Jesus Christ. Like, so I shoved my finger into this, you know, this huge power thing. It was one of those things. Like, I walked out and one of the technical directors was like, oh, what happened? And I told him, and he was like, you did what? There was a person stuck hanging in the air. It was them or me.
Your finger solved it, or was it like a switch you were holding?
Like a little, like a manual. So the way that it worked is like, you know, there's like a big chunk that moves to connect the wires, and that chunk wasn't moving. And you kind of have, there's a part at the top where you can just, it's only supposed to see if you can see the thing moving. It's not meant for you to shove your finger into it, actuate it. It's meant for you to tell, does this work? Does this not work? I'm looking at it and he did the thing and I'm like, well, it doesn't work. I'm like, I got one idea. It's not a good one.
At least he didn't get electrocuted, I suppose.
To this day, it was probably one of the dumbest decisions I've ever made. Because, I mean, I was seriously like, well, I know how it works, but I don't know if it's supposed to... Oh, what the fuck? It kind of went, okay, there's now not a person stuck in the air, and I'm going to go have a beer.
Yeah, you definitely deserve one out of that.
And that may have actually... Yeah. Oh, I can lead straight into another story, speaking about beer.
Okay.
We had a beer fridge in the tech office on tour. So you had the big top, you got a technical office attached to it. We had a giant, it was an under counter fridge that you'd see it like a movie theater, you know, like the two big silver things with two big doors.
Okay.
We double stacked them. So we had two of those. We had four doors. The bottom was filled with beer. The top one side was filled with beer and the other side was filled with Red Bull. It's a tour, you know.
Sounds good.
And we ran off of a honor system. And there was just a sheet on the front. And you would just tick, I'm taking a beer. And you would owe whatever the cost was. And it actually eventually turned into a game with us. So I was one of two people that was maintenance staff. We were the only people that were technically not a part of the running show. But we were backup staff if someone called in sick. If someone called in sick, they'd always move the people around so that the only hole would be in a spotlight. Well, to be in a spotlight, you had to put on a climbing harness and climb up a truss to get up to the spotlight. So for the maintenance guys, our goal was to basically finish our work and get to the beer fridge before the technical director could talk to you, because you're not allowed to climb anything if you've consumed any alcohol. Okay. So you literally like run to the beer fridge, be like, he'd walk in, it'd be me and this other guy. We called him Dude. His name was Brian, but we called him Dude. And it usually, you know, like our technical director usually walk into me and Dude just sitting there like, hi, Dude. You know, like, oh, the city came. Sorry. And yeah, it was one of our, I don't want to say it was a favorite activity, but it was definitely turned into a part of our standard working day to sort of see if we could get the beer in before the technical director could grab
us. That's so funny. And would the performers be a little bit more reserved maybe then? Because you talked about your wild lifestyle, and I'm like,
they weren't. They did have, and I can't remember what they call it. They do have terms in their contract, you know, where they can't put themselves in unnecessary risk sort of situation. So yes. As you're traveling, they can't get like on a jet ski or go skydiving or anything like that. You know.
Oh my God. So does that mean they can't do those things for like 12 years or whatever?
However long they're with the tour.
They're working. Oh my God.
Yeah. And like in unfortunate cases, and I won't look into details, but you know, like there was in my case on a tour, one of the people got injured skiing. Badly injured skiing. And she was life-changing injuries, but it was classed as a high risk activity. So she was technically in violation of her contract.
So probably not covered then.
We don't know exactly how it happened, not what happened in the background, but we do know that she was deemed as, you know, and we understand took care of the situation and her fine, but it was still, you know, it was still one of those things where, you know, they kind of had to come back and like, hey, you guys understand you can't be doing this stuff.
Yeah. So like, even if they hadn't been life changing, I suppose, yeah, if someone like was on a night out maybe and broke a leg, like that's them out of the show. Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. So well, I mean, obviously if it was something, you know, if you walk out of a pub and you trip, they're not going to say you were doing a high, you know, nobody's going to come at you for a high risk activity. Well, I would hope.
Well, yeah, but I suppose what I'm more saying is that they probably had to be really careful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There was a time where their photos surfaced of one of her performers dangling off of a truss at a nightclub. And it was kind of like,
yikes.
Yeah, it was probably one of those. You probably should have thought about that better. Situations yeah. where you're kind of like, yeah, there's not really a defense there. So yeah, but generally they were, you know, they were within, you know, certainly in the partying moods, but yeah, as far as getting into the more sensational stupidity, they were usually not so involved. Not that they were completely immune, but yeah.
Yeah. They dip the toe.
Yeah, yeah. They'd get close. They'd get close sometimes. But you know, it would also depend on though, because so we had a lot of strong nationalities in ours, you know, as far as Russians. And I mean, these are not the American version of Russians. These are Russians from Russia, and then Georgians and Ukrainians, you know, they're not all great bedfellows. You know, and then you got a whole bunch of Americans. And Canadians, there's a lot of culture gaps that sort of happen. Some of them are difficult to deal with. Some of them are just kind of surprising. Some of them are fun. I hope no Georgians listen to this. If you're listening, sorry. They are the most obnoxiously homophobic people I've ever met.
No way.
Yeah, just, and I mean, they're all great people, but there was like one of my favorite, I got a haircut once and showed up at a pub and one of the Georgians was standing out front, you know, and I made mention to him, you know, just, hi, how are you? And he's like, you got a haircut. I'm like, yeah, it looks really good, but not too good. I don't mean good, good. I don't mean good. I don't mean you look good. And was like, dude, calm down. It's cool. You want a hug? You know, like, but and it was one of those things that I found I was able to kind of play with a little bit as time went on. But, you know, it was one of those things that we found out. It's just like, they apparently are very, you know, it's just, it's very culturally, they're very homophobic and, you know, but, you know, they're also on a tour. So they, you know, they have to accept a certain amount of culture shock as well. So, like I said, some of it was amusing. Some of it was difficult. Some of it wasn't. But yeah, so you always kind of had to deal with, you know, a lot. Generally, all the performers were all the, you know, the Russian, Ukrainian, you know, so that kind of, I don't want to say provided a convenient culture gap, but it did prevent too much of technicians influencing performers or vice versa.
Yeah.
It kind of helped keep things a little bit calm between the gap.
Yeah. So they were probably like two, you're all a big family, but at the same time, you've got groups within the family and.
Yes. Oh yeah, exactly. Yeah. Things like that, you know, and I mean, there was always, everybody was great at outreach. So the technical truck that was our office, because once the trucks are all empty, quite a few of them turned into used spaces. So the truck that we used for our office had the truck number 54. So it was called the 54. That if anyone said the 54, they were talking about the technicians in the technical office. We would, so that beer fridge, whatever profit was made off of it, every so often we would throw what was called a 54 party.
Cool.
And it was, so I think we were in Columbus, Ohio, of all places. And we decided we had enough money for one of these 54 parties. And there was a big power pole right in the middle of like the technical area. Nothing attached to it. No clue what it was for, why it was there, anything. But there was a big power pole right in the middle of our area. So we built a boat around this power pole. So the power pole was the mast. And we built, it was, I mean, it had to be 12 feet tall, 30 feet wide. We put, we made cannons and filled them with confetti, and you would fire it with fire extinguishers. Oh, and it was all pirate themed. So it was the pirate party. And it was just, I mean, we brought in a truck full of sand and made a beach. And yeah, oh my gosh. Just Oh yeah, created themed, like depending on the party, it'd be themed areas. You know, all the bars were themed. All, you know, all the technical crew, we were all dressed to the nines in pirate costumes. And yeah, and it was just, we called it a 54 party, and we would do those from time to time. And it was, I mean, it was literally the whole tour was invited. It was like, hey, everybody come out. We're having ourselves a party. And we would just, yeah, I mean, go absolutely bonkers with it. And that was, you know, it was one of those things that really kind of, you know, it was just a culture. It helped, you know, keep this culture of kind of family. And, you know, occasionally, it doesn't matter what you're doing, occasionally everybody needs to have a release.
Yes.
So, and it worked out really well. It was a lot of fun. And I can't remember, we did one in Australia when my wife and I were together, and I can't remember even what the theme was. I decided to go weird with it, and I went to a costume shop and got a full body frog costume. But then I even went more and I had them do a gangster frog. So I got like a fedora and I had them bolt it to the frog's head and a vest. I don't, it was one of those, like, I don't even know what was going on. It was a dark time in my life. I guess. I just walked around all day like, what are you? I'm like, I'm a gangster frog. And they're like, why?
It's the worst when you have to explain your costume.
Well, and that was it. People are like, why?
Why not?
Yeah.
And do you ever miss it?
I do. Some of the story, there are fun stories, you know, some of the ways you could play with people. In North America, when the tour is just started, it comes out of Canada. So the staff is heavily Canadian and heavily French Canadian. And so you're speaking with French Canadians. I when I joined the tour, I was one of like three Americans or something out of 150 people.
Whoa.
It's huge. But I spent so much time with these people that after several months, I spoke my English like them. So okay. I was speaking my English as if I was a French Canadian speaking English.
And I presume French Canadians, like, you, French is their first language, right? So they speak English like a French person speaking English.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So and the side effect of this was, is I just, because I was never exposed to anyone else, this is just the way I talked all the time. And there were times, and there were great, there was a woman on tour that, I don't want to say we didn't get along. She was very stern, stoic, you know, just very, very, yeah, woman with edges. And we got along fine, but when you get to drinking and things change. So what would happen is since I spoke my English this way, French speakers, some of them, especially if they were drinking, thought I would speak French.
Yeah, they all said,
because they'd hear my English the way I was speaking my English, and they'd be like, oh, well, he's, and then they'd launch into French. This day, I mean, I know a handful of phrases, but so I, you know, I learned things like j'ai hâte de vince, which is get me a screwdriver. And, you know, and I, that was my go-to phrase, because, you know, I'd speak, I, you know, and one night I was speaking with this very stern young woman, and she popped into the French, and, you know, just, you know, staring at her like, holy crap. And then when she finished, I just go, j'ai hâte de vince. Cause that was my go-to, you know, I was like, cause I figured if no matter what she said, whatever I said has got to be wrong. You know, like there's no way whatever she said equals what my answer was. And in this instance, her face dropped. Like as soon as I said j'ai hâte de vince, she's like, I was like, what? Because earlier somebody had taught me how to say kiss my ass, and it turned out that they actually taught me how to say lick my asshole. And apparently the way you conjugate verbs, he said it wasn't a joke, it was an offer. It was like, I'm going to stay away from that one.
So you accidentally asked her.
No. So that was my experience before, you know. So yeah. I changed to j'ai hâte de vince. I don't know if she had ever heard this story, but as soon as I said j'ai hâte de vince, her face dropped. She's like, and I was like, oh shit, I did it again. She made me apologize, grovel, beg. And after like 10 minutes, she looked at me and goes, you know, I'm fucking with you, right?
She's
like, most stoic human being on the planet I'd ever met. And like, she had me,
and
like,
she got
on my
you
knees.
Good.
Like, I was like, I am so sorry.
She had you convinced you'd said something else.
Oh yeah, for ages. And then like, this was a public setting. We were, it was in the middle of a party, and it was just like, oh my God.
Fair play. Yeah,
yeah, it was one of those. Okay, you win.
You were like, okay,
that's,
I have to give you that one.
Yeah. Like, there will be no comeback. That was good. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your stories. It's really interesting.
No problem. It's been a lot of fun.
Such a different, like, life experience.
It is. It is. It's been fun. You know what? And I get to say I had that. We all get to complain, but I at least have some good stories.
Yeah. Do you want to let everyone know, I suppose? Oh, you said you're not really on the internet.
No. I'm slightly involved in politics, and I'm not going to get into it on a podcast like
fair
this.
Enough. Yeah.
So, so generally I was just looking for a bit of fun, and I've always enjoyed watching the Tri-Channel. Actually, my wife and I fell in love with all the videos, watching Irish people, everything. And it's kind of interesting hearing my wife's take on it and then my take on it and see where we meet in the middle watching, you know, because she tends to see from your guys' eyes where, you know, for some of the foods you guys are like, oh my God. I'm like, yeah, it's fine. You know, and then vice versa. So that was, we always bonded. So yeah. So when I came across your request, I was like, why not? Sounds like fun.
Yeah.
And it's breaking the monotony.
But yeah. So I guess we'll just say if anyone finds it super interesting, go check out Cirque du Soleil when it's back up and running. I presume it's not running at the minute. And actually, that probably would have been a bit really affected, would it?
Yeah, I don't want to say shut down, but I know they've
paused.
I mean, they've gone down to very bare staff. I know that they have now started the discussions of it continuing again, but I don't think there's a timeline known yet.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
But there's quite a lot of stuff that COVID has affected that you forget about. Like, I never would have thought of Cirque du Soleil particularly, but it's such a huge production and it would have affected
thousands
so many people.
Yeah. Yeah. That's huge hits. Yeah. Yeah. The entertainment industry, I think, has been one of the absolute worst hits in all of this.
Yes.
Yeah. So it is. I think everybody's looking forward. You know, I miss it as well now too. It's something that is, you know, it is very difficult. So.
And my last question, if it came to like near you, would you go see it?
Oh, anytime. I would go back and see the show I watched for 4 years. I mean, I think their shows are that good.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I worked on one show for 4 years, and I mean, right to the end, I'd be outside singing along with it just as excited as the first time. No, it is a great show. They do great things. You know, I think that it was, you know, definitely one of the highlights of my life.
Thank you so much for sharing. That was such a lovely story.
Thank you.
Set of stories.
Went set
from
of stories,
rock and roll to just like a wholesome family atmosphere. It's really good.
A little bit of everything.
So thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you so much for watching. The Storytime Podcast is on a video podcast on YouTube, but it's also available on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. If you could leave us a review, that'd be amazing. It would really help us out in the old rankings. And Dominic, thank you so much again.
And thank you.
I'll see you in the next one. Bye.
Bye.
This podcast was brought to you by The Shift. For more like this, check out theshift.ie.